Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Don Blunt, and I'm editor of The Record, and I'm sitting here with Alex Breitler, former Record staff writer, now a public information officer at San Joaquin Delta College. And what we're doing is we are going to discuss a few stories that Alex wrote while at The Record as part of our violent crime project. In this project, we've already looked at a few of the victims or survivors of victims of violent crime in Stockton. Brief reviews that we talked to these people about their loved ones, and we talked to people who were involved in these accidents or murders going back as far as 10 years. So Alex interviewed two families and wrote two stories for us, and we're going to talk about those now. So how are you doing, Alex?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Don.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Salvador Castañón family, and just describe to listeners how you went about reporting that story, how you found this family, and why you selected them as a good example for this story.
Well, I went through Record archives looking specifically for homicides that happened, roughly 10 years ago. And I also kind of wanted to find a family to write about where there's somewhat different circumstances. We write a lot about young victims of crime, which are obviously very tragic cases. This case, this particular case, involved a 76-year-old gentleman who was killed, a grandfather, now a great-grandfather. And that's very different than a lot of the cases that we write about in Stockton. So I was interested in finding out how that affected his family later on. I mean, we're talking multiple generations of people. He now has 14 great-grandchildren who were not living when he was killed. So that's an entire generation of this man's family that he did not have a chance to meet. And that really has profoundly affected his family. So I just thought it would be really interesting to meet with the family of an older homicide victim, because, you know, some people might be inclined to say, well, he lived a good long life, and he did. But that doesn't make it any less tragic. Mm-hmm. And the impacts upon this family 10 years later are still very, very severe. So I just thought it would be important to tell a story like that along with the others.
So what did you find? What's the difference between survivors of an older victim versus survivors of a younger victim?
I'm not sure that there really is that much of a difference. I mean, first of all, they believe that he would still be alive today. He was in good health. He was 76 years old, but he was in good health. So they believe that he would have met all of these great-grandchildren and would have a relationship with them, just like he did with his grandchildren. He was known for kind of the typical grandpa relationship. He would, you know, he would dance with his granddaughters in the hallway, and he would slip money into his grandkids' hands so they could go to McDonald's and all that kind of fun stuff that grandpas do. And they were hoping, they were assuming that he would be around to do that with his great-grandchildren as well.
Because he'd be about 88, 89 years old about now.
He would be, you know, he would certainly be, he would be in his upper 80s, but he was in good health at the time that he was killed. And I think there's every expectation on behalf of the family that he would still be here today. So he has missed an entire generation. And go ahead. Sorry.
So that's okay. So with what I notice is with younger victims or survivors of younger victims, you sort of hear about the life that was lost, what they did not get opportunity to do. With an older victim, is it more so a thing of legacy and reaching down to that younger generation that's being missed?
Yeah, absolutely. They all missed out on a chance to know him as his grandchildren did. And it's, you know, it affects them in very profound ways. I mean, they talked about how every time there's a child born into this family, which is a very large family now, it's certainly a joyful time when there's a birth in the family, but there's also the feeling of, you know, oh, we wish that he could be here. to meet this child, this great grandchild. We wish that he could hold this child and have a picture taken with this child. And so there's this tinge of sadness that accompanies even these very joyful events, which is just tragic all these years later, that even in these great, wonderful moments, that there's just a little hint of sadness.
So how do you I've asked other writers this same question, so I'm going to ask you as well. How do you really approach a family and say, hey, I want to write about this painful topic?
Well, I mean, obviously, you want to be compassionate first and foremost. I mean, you want to be a human being before anything else. It's not about the story. It's about the people. So I reached out to his daughters. And
how'd you come across them?
I had to find them on social media. I mean, these are cases that, I mean, this is a 10-year-old case. And it is difficult to track folks down after 10 years in some cases. So I found them on social media, and I just sent them a note, private note, that said in the most sensitive terms possible what we were trying to do, and, you know, asked them if they would be willing to just talk about how this event 10 years ago changed the trajectory of their family.
Okay.
And I think in most cases, and I was a full-time COPS reporter for a number of years, I think in most cases, families, they really want to share about those kinds of things. You know, they want to honor their loved ones, and they want to kind of tell the world why this mattered, why their loved one was so special, and they want the world to know that they're still suffering after all these years. Which, you know, I mean, our society, you know, we read about these things and we move on as a society. You know, we move on to different cases, different stories, sadly. And I think it meant a lot to them that we still cared enough after all these years to want to reach out to him.
Do you think it gave them opportunity to sort of keep his memory alive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what, I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to be in their shoes. But I think I might want to do the same thing with one of my loved ones. If I was contacted years later by a journalist, I think that I would really want to participate in something like this, just mm-hmm. because it is a way of keeping their memory alive mm-hmm. and reminding the world that this person mattered.
Mm. Now, for us, I'm looking at the story, and actually it was more than 12 years ago that this happened, but you mentioned that you sort of found them on social media. So for listeners, connect some dots for me here. I mean, how really do you go about and find a family on social media or however, whatever method you use to try and find them? How do you do that?
Well, if you just search for the name, I mean, it depends on who you're looking for.
Let's talk about this case.
Right. In this case, his daughter, one of his daughters, still has the same last name, so she popped up on Facebook, and it really wasn't that difficult to kind of connect the dots and figure out that she was related to him. We had written articles about him at the time of his death, and we had quoted members of his family. So I believe I saw her name in one of our previous articles. This is going back many years. So I knew that was her, and it was a unique enough name. I knew that it was her, and I was comfortable reaching out. And actually, it's interesting, many of them, and I looked at a number of families. I wrote about these two families, but I looked at a number of them, and they are still talking on social media about their loved ones. So if you go and you look at their Facebook wall or whatever, you may very well find posts that they have written just in the last few years.
Are they public?
In some cases. In other cases, they're not.
Okay.
But in some cases, they're public. And that's how you know, obviously, that this is the person that you need to contact. And that's usually, you know, if it's a public post and they're talking about their loved one, that to me is a sign that they may be receptive to, you know, to speaking with a journalist. And obviously, again, you still want to be very sensitive in how you approach them. And if they're not interested, obviously, let it go immediately. That's my approach. But usually, if they're still talking about it on social media, they'll be interested in talking to a journalist about it.
Okay. So in this interview with this story, what was sort of your takeaway, the thing that affected you the most?
You know what? It was the sheer number of people who were there.
How many, roughly?
I couldn't even tell you. It was the guy's entire family. It was his His two daughters were there. He has another daughter who lives out of the area, but two daughters were there. A whole slew of grandchildren, the spouses of grandchildren, the children of the grandchildren, so the great-grandchildren were there. I stepped into this house, and the living room was full of people. And actually, as a reporter, you go into a situation like that, it's a little bit intimidating because it's a bit more difficult. You know, you like to be able to kind of focus and talk to maybe just a few or a handful of people at one time so you can keep track of what everyone is saying and keep everything straight in your mind. It was a little overwhelming to have that many people there, but we adjusted and we just kind of went around the room. I explained what we were trying to do and invited anyone who felt like speaking up to participate, and some of them chose to and some of them chose not to, and that's totally fine. Mm. And we just basically opened it up as really more of a conversation than a structured interview, and just gave them a chance to share whatever it is they wanted to share about their father or their grandpa, their great-grandpa. Mm. So it was a meaningful experience for me, and it really reminded me how many people are affected by these crimes. You know, we talk about hundreds of homicide victims going back a decade.
Right.
But then you think about the fathers, the siblings, the children, the grandchildren, the uncles, the aunts, the cousins, not to mention the friends. Exponentially, I mean, there are thousands of people in this town who have lost somebody that they love to violent crime. And you step into this guy's living room, that's just one case. Mm-hmm. And all of these people still mourning his loss. I thought it was very powerful.
Well, that sort of segues, I guess, into the other story that you wrote about Trevell George. I'm looking at the story again, and one of the things that you wrote was how every time something happens, it sort of brings his mother back to this, and how it's the little things that always sort of jogs her memories back to him. So, again, let's just look a little bit about this story and tell listeners sort of what you came away with from how you got into the story and sort of what you came away with.
Sure. Well, this is another case that we wrote about at the time that it happened. We wrote several stories, and then it just kind of unfortunately went away like so many other cases do in the public eye. I found Travell's mother, Tracy, through a mutual friend on social media. And Tracy was more than willing to sit down and talk about her son. This case, as opposed to the previous case, this case is still unsolved. Mm-hmm. So there's the kind of the added motivation of trying to keep the case in the public eye so that hopefully one day there will be justice in this case that may make family members even more inclined to speak. I think you nailed it when you said that there's just these little things that come up in Tracy's life that remind her of him. The example in the story is whenever there's something wrong with her car.
Right.
She's driving down the road and her car starts sputtering. She thinks of her son because he was mechanically inclined and he liked to work on cars. His father taught him how to do that. And so it's just little, and I'm sure there's 1,000 other examples that I don't know about, but little things like that virtually on a day-to-day basis bring him to her mind. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to me, it's just striking to think about how difficult that is. That must be to on a literally every day to have something happen that brings your son to mind. How difficult that must be. But she was very generous with her time with us. We spent a number of hours with her, and she's got a lot going on in her life right now. But I was thankful to her, and I always, as a reporter, I was always very thankful to families who were willing to share, these intimate details. It's very brave of them.
Are you surprised at how much people will share about their private lives?
Yeah. I don't know. I think there's a kind of a, you know, we live in this age where people are very concerned about security of their information with social media and the internet, and I think there's kind of this expectation that people want to be left alone. And that they don't want to have reporters come in to talk to them, and that they want to be able to grieve in peace, which of course is absolutely their right. But I think people would be surprised. Again, this is just my experience, but I did a lot of these kinds of stories as a cops reporter. I think people would be surprised how many of these families really do want to talk. And, you know, I'm not claiming to be a therapist or anything like that, but you know, does it help them? Does it help them to some extent to be able to talk about this
stuff? Well, the word that keeps coming up is cathartic, that you're, as a journalist, you're there, they're having the conversation, and in a lot of cases, almost like a flood of information and relief and sharing comes out of them to you as you're sitting there with your pen and pad or recorder and just talking about this loved one, and they have the opportunity to just tell you what a great person that their loved one was and what they're missing. In Travel's case, he would be the opposite of Salvador Castañón because he was not even 20 before his death occurred.
Yeah, he had his whole life in front of him. He was a football player, came out of Franklin High, was pretty well known back in the day. He was going to Chico State. He was kind of trying to figure out, you know, what he wanted to do with his life, and came home for break, and was killed while basically just standing on the sidewalk with some of his friends. It was someone who walked up with a gun and opened fire, and the case was never solved. So yeah, it was very tragic, and like so many other cases in Stockton involving young people who have their whole lives in front of them, Travel lost his. One interesting thing to consider here is that you do, when you sit down with these families, you find out about little slivers of hope that come out of these kinds of stories. And one of the interesting stories about Travel involves his brother Clarence, who his mother told me very vividly about how Clarence got up at Travel's funeral and said something to the effect of, to this crowd of thousands of people in this church, said, you know, this will not be in vain. You know, I'm gonna do something with my life. I'm gonna take this tragedy and I'm gonna turn it into something positive. And he went on to Michigan State, and he's working on a degree in
I think it's African American.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, and his goal is to really kind of go out and address some of the basic fundamental causes of violence in our communities, which is exactly what took his brother 10 years ago. So there are little good things that come out of these horrible mm-hmm. events that you hear about from these families.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that would definitely be something good. I think that one of the overriding themes that we've seen through the stories done by you and Roger Phillips, Almendra Carpizo, and Nicholas Philippus is just this overriding sense of loss, the almost rip from their soul that a lot of these survivors have. And I'm grateful that the people we talked to were willing to share, because I think in part that it helps us to tell the community the real effects of this, because as you mentioned, and we mentioned in these other conversations, we go, we cover, people mourn, and then everybody walks away, and poof, you know, people have nothing left. And
yeah.
At least now we can take a little bit of a glimpse back and then try to understand and get a little glimpse of exactly what they've experienced.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, and I'm no expert, but I'm not certain, based on my own experience writing about these kinds of cases, that the pain really diminishes that much over time. We're talking about cases that are 10 years old, and they still affect these families in very, very strong and powerful ways every day.
Yeah.
So it's just something to consider. Just because a case may seem like ancient history, it's certainly not for the people who are directly involved by it,
right,
or affected by it.
Right, exactly. Well, Alex, thanks for coming back and having this chat. I appreciate it.
Sure, thank you. It was an honor to write these stories, my last stories as a journalist. So I hope that they, in some way, helped the families.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Thank you.